Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Joining us here for the first 20 minutes of the hour, Congressman John Shimkus of the Illinois 19th Congressional District. We're going to be talking about two things. One, of course, the president's address last night to the nation, in which he dealt mostly with the issue of the ongoing war on terrorism. We'll find out what Congressman Shimkus has to say about that. We'll also be talking a little bit later with Congressman about the debut of a new internet domain for kids that has just been unveiled. He has been spearheading the effort for the .kids domain. We'll find out what that's all about as well. Our phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Congressman John Shimkus is a regular guest here on Issues Etc. John, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
What's your general reaction to the president's nationwide address last night?
I'm somber. I think those of us who have been supportive of this president and the administration have known all along that we were in for a long haul, and really what the president did was, you know, kind of remind the American public that, you know, we're in it for the long haul, and it's tough, and it's hard going, and it's going to be costly, but in the end, we think a free democratic Iraq is the best opportunity to change the cycle of violence in the Middle East than any other thing that's been tried.
The president announced last night that he would be asking the Congress for $87 billion, at least as a start, to help defray the cost of the efforts both in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Will he get this allotment of money?
Well, I think he will. Now, whether he'll get as much as he's proposed, I think many of us were ready to write a pretty big check to begin with, but he's kind of quadrupled the amount that we were, I think, initially envisioning. So, you know, it's just going to be a matter of, you know, the reasoning, the logic, the amount, and maybe for a lot of us, where will there be what we would call offsets, or where can we find savings in other spending? You know, this really goes to the heart of the old guns and butter debate that we've had in this country for a long time. And where, you know, that's a lot of money. But in the end, if you continue to push the frontiers of the terrorist locations, and you keep putting the pressure on them, I do concur with the president. If you're taking the fight to them, then there's a better chance they're going to have difficulties of bringing that fight to your home. But this is a tough world in which we live in, and we hope that we're right. But terrorism is easily exported, and with technology and dollars, no one can really ensure the safety of anybody. All you can do is keep up the fight and keep up the pressure. And I think the folks, you know, when I was back for the entire month of August, I think one of the things that a lot of the people liked about the administration is they knew that the president was persistent in his pursuit to take the war to the terrorists.
So as far as feedback on the war with Iraq, how would you characterize it as you traveled around your district?
I think the people are always concerned with the loss of U.S. lives, men and women in uniform, and the dangers presented. But I would not say that changed their resolve in that they were supportive of the administration. They want an administration that's going to do something, not nothing. And I think for too long in the past, we allowed terrorism to have its way with little to no response. And at least the folks that I talk to understand that this president has got it resolved, and he's implementing it.
Something else the president mentioned last night was that he was authorizing Secretary of State Colin Powell to go to the UN to seek authorization for foreign involvement. He said that some of the nations would like to be involved, but they'd feel better with UN authorization to do this. What do you see the prospects being for that particular endeavor?
Well, it's kind of the bureaucratic aspects of international relations, and the UN is a place. That's why I've always not been a strong proponent of a large or expanded UN, but I've always said there's a role that they should play. So I've never been one who voted just to totally, you know, eliminate or leave the UN. And some there are countries that need, quote unquote, the cover of saying, okay, it's now blessed by the UN. It is now an internationally approved operation, and now we will go. There are many other countries that are already engaged and involved with us over in Iraq. Of course, we all know the United Kingdom, and we also have some appreciation for what Spain has done. Many people don't know that there's a brigade of Polish soldiers over in Iraq, and among those Polish soldiers, there's companies from the Baltic countries that, of course, is an area that I work closely with, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. There is an international presence, but it's not under, quote-unquote, the official title of the UN. Other countries like Germany and maybe France would be more apt to do that with a proper resolution. And to them, us going that way might, in their eyes, be a sign that at least we maybe we were at fault by not going to them first. The UN is not an organization to go to fight and win wars because they'll never make a decision. Can they be helpful in administering the peace? The answer is yes, and so I don't have any problem with the administration making that attempt.
Great Britain announced today that they would be sending 3,000 more troops to Iraq, bringing their total number of troops in that theater to about 14,000. If there is greater involvement of other nations sending troops to Iraq, will this help forestall what many people perceive as kind of their biggest fear, and that is that length of tours in Iraq are going to extend to a whole year as opposed to, say, 6 or 9 months?
That's hard to tell. We've got troops rotating back now. Some have been there for a long time. I have a friend who's a brigade commander with 101st who was there at the beginning of the war, and he's still there with his brigade. So, and I'm not sure what our men and women in uniform and the families are thinking about as far as the length of tour. This is a volunteer army that is very professional and knows the job requirements and knows that they have to go upon when called to serve. I mean, we've had soldiers on 1 year unaccompanied tours in Korea for over 50 years. We've had accompanied tours in Europe for 3 years. Long extended tours of duty are not something that's unknown to our military forces and operations. I think where there is a credible debate and discussion is where you have reservists and guardsmen. Because of the changing nature of the military, we have a continued reliance on the guards and reserves. Those, you know, quote-unquote, and I'm one of them, part-time soldiers are really full-time soldiers now. And if there's anyone who needs to be relieved of the time in theater, it would be members of the guards and reserves.
We're talking with Congressman John Shimkus of the Illinois 19th Congressional District about President Bush's address last night to the nation. Now, if you have a question or a comment for Congressman Shimkus, give us a call now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What do you think, Congressman? Did we have an adequate post-war plan for Iraq?
Well, probably the consensus now is no, we didn't. I think we still thought the Iraqis would dig in their heels. We thought that Saddam would deploy chemical weapons against our forces, and a lot of areas were bypassed, and really many of the soldiers melted away. Now, the challenge, I've had friends, my roommate just returned from Iraq, a member of Congress from Minnesota, and continues to highlight a lot of the great success stories that are over there that you don't hear, because rightly so, when men and women fall because of terrorist attacks and bombings, that should take a credible amount of news stories. But there still are, you know, a lot of successes going on, and the vast majority of the country is being run by Iraqis. But we do have three elements that are causing us problems. One is Saddam released 100,000 hardened criminals. When we went to the prisons were empty. Well, where did those guys go? Well, they melted back into society, and they're thugs, and they're criminals, and they're bad guys. And that's one part of the problem. The second part of the problem is the Ba'athist regime that still holds on to the hope that Saddam will return to power. Saddam Hussein will not return to power, especially if the United States stays on the ground. And that's where we're continuing to move on, closing down the chapter on the deck of cards. And I guess we got about 42 out of the 52 deck of cards, and we're making great progress, but we still got to get Saddam Hussein. And the third group is the Islamic fundamentalists, the Al-Qaeda organizations that's slipping through the borders of Syria, that's using this as really the testing ground to see if the United States is what they thought we were in past administration, is the toothless tiger that'll melt away in the face of adversity. And that's where the president speaks strongly that, no, we're there for the distance.
Were our troops adequately trained, or could they possibly be trained to go from being, albeit aggressors and combatants, to essentially peacekeepers or police?
It's very tough. I'm an infantryman myself. There's great stories of how primarily our infantrymen have tried to make that transition. There's been debates on end strength and the number of military forces and special the special operations is not just the Green Berets and the Rangers. It's also the special operators are the people who go in and the civil service type of folks, civil affairs organizations, and they help rebuild democracy. But they have historically been small elements, and so because I think all the reserve military policemen that we have in this country were all deployed. So even with all the deployment of all the military police assets, both active and reserve, we still had to use, you know, basic grunts, infantrymen, to do some of that other type of policing activity. And it's a challenge. I think they've got a tremendous and excellent record. Have there been mistakes? Yes. But I think if you look at over all the thousands of contacts that are made between Iraqi people and our U.S. military, I think it's a statement to be proud of how our military has responded in a very challenging environment.
How do you respond to critics of President Bush who say that, you know, we still haven't found those weapons of mass destruction?
Well, I would say the president's still firm and resolved that we will find them, and even if we don't, my first answer is, 8,000 liters of aflatoxin was what we knew, the UN knew, that he had when they were kicked out, and there are no records of that being destroyed. Now, that is about the size. You put all those 8,000 liters, sounds like a lot, but it's enough to fit into the back of a small U-Haul trailer. So you put it in a small U-Haul trailer, and you take it out to the desert, and you bury it. I don't think you're going to find it unless there's a GPS chip on there. And so Iraq is the size of California. So that's response number one. Response number two is, what if he did destroy it all and he was just bluffing? Why would he do that? Why would he not show us his meticulous records of how and where he destroyed this stuff? The answer is he was playing a very dangerous game. He wanted to be the power in the area and have the fear of his weapons of mass destruction at hand, to be, you know, the next rebuilder of the Babylon Empire, and he threw the dice that he could bluff his way, and he lost.
Critics have also said that Iraq, and especially they've been saying this quite a bit since last night's address by the president, that Iraq never should have become the focus of the war on terrorism. Al Qaeda attacked us. It was not Iraq that attacked us. Your response to that?
Well, I will still. I mean, I voted for military operation. I still believe that if you have an Al Qaeda organization that's willing to have suicide bombers to grab planes, it is not a far stretch. This extreme fundamentalism, and I wish I could remember the terminology I used in my NATO briefings, but. It's apocalyptic terrorism. This Al-Qaeda is into apocalyptic terrorism. You know, most terrorists like to go to the negotiating table, and based upon the damage they've done, they're going to try to get a piece of the new coalition government. They want this, want that. What Al-Qaeda wants to do, and what Islamic fundamentalism wants to do, is they want to blow up the conference table. And this type of apocalyptic terrorism should not leave anybody with any thought other than if they could get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, they would definitely do that. And then you would see a damage and the death and destruction that we have only feared. And so, given that they're in the same region, they have the same goals. It's not too. I just don't think it's a big leap to say they both hate the United States. One has the capability of producing it. One has probably the capability of delivering it. That seems like something that could be pulled off.
Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean is now saying that it's time to bring our troops home. How do you assess that statement?
Well, I'm just glad he's not the president of the United States. We brought our soldiers home from Beirut, and that didn't stop terrorism. We brought our folks out of Somalia. That didn't stop terrorism. We got blown up in at the coal, the ship, and threw a few cruise missiles in Afghanistan. That didn't stop terrorism. We had attacks on three or four embassies with little to no response. That didn't stop terrorism. So the question is, is this our major threat to our country and to the world today? Is the fear of apocalyptic Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, is that the defined threat to the world today? And if it is, then this war has to continue to be fought and won.
Final question on the war, and perhaps this expands beyond just the war. At the recent debate of a majority of the Democratic candidates for president, Representative Dick Gephardt got quite a bit of an applause in that forum by declaring several times that this president on the issue of the war and the economy was, I think he said, miserable failure. How do you respond?
Dick Gephardt, who I know and I've served with, is running for president. And I think it's very early to make a judgment on the president's stewardship of, one, the economy. Everybody understands the great assault the economy took with the attacks on September 11th, and have we been successful forestalling any other great events? The answer is yes so far, and the question is the economy better off today than it was in the past? And I would think anyone who's looking at the markets and the economic signals say that there are promising signs out there. So I let these people make all their proclamations they want, because the real proof of the pudding is going to be how are we a year from now? Are we safer? Is Iraq more restrained? And do we have a governing operation? Has the economy turned around? These guys are positioning to be the chosen one. From the Democratic Party, so they're going to have to continue to be pretty outrageous in their comments, and they're really gambling. That's what they're doing. They're not really total belief. Is they're gambling that they'll get the vast majority of support from the liberal left that really obviously not supportive of conservative ideology and this administration, and then they have to gamble. And it's not a gamble that I don't think I'd like to put money on, that we're going to be in worse shape next year than we are today.
Now, last week you announced the beginning of a new internet domain, .kids.us. Tell us about it.
Well, I think we've actually talked about this maybe a year ago and such. It's legislation. Sometimes something happens and you can move legislation real quick and things fall into place. Other times, legislation takes many, many years. I'm not even sure who started the actual discussion, but with the advent of the World Wide Web, we know with all the benefits it brings to us, there are inherent dangers, especially for young children. And that danger comes from unwanted, unasked for pornography. It comes from stalkers on internet chat rooms. It comes from the ability for you to be on sites and then, in essence, use hyperlinks to get to sites that you do not want to be in, and it's a mistake, and then you're trapped with explicit sexual pictures that it's difficult to turn off, except for resetting the computer or pulling the plugs. So the struggle has always been, how do you constitutionally and technologically protect your kids? We've tried things legally through legislation. Children's Online Protection Act is one. We also had one on internet filtering, which drew the ire of the librarians for a lot of reasons. And so they just didn't seem to be as successful. Many of us then started talking about creating a red light district and establishing a triple X top-level domain and just kind of pushing all the nastiness into one area and then helping parents with software that would, you know, prohibit kids going to the triple X top-level domain. But the problem is that we had sites already established for pornographers that we would, in essence, be taking their name and their constitutional issues and problems. So then we said, let's make a green light. Let's do it in a positive approach. Let's establish a green light approach, voluntary. You place the information on there voluntary. You have to meet these guidelines, and that's the advent of the kids.us. .us is the server for the country, and it is we have a company that administers the U.S. top-level domain, and that's Neustar. And all we did in the legislation was, okay, Neustar, if you want this lucrative contract to manage the U.S. top-level domain, you have to set up a subdomain, which is a .kids, that will be information only for kids appropriate under the age of 13, no chat rooms, no hyperlinks. And that's the advent of it, signed into law by the president in December. They've unrolled it now, and we're looking for people to set up, you know, and it's a perfect thing. And part of the doing the press release is to get people on board, getting parents to call in to companies that they do business and say, you know, we want you to have a site on the kids.us. KFU ought to have one. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod better have one, and I'll be calling them because that's exactly the type of groups. You know, I've already made calls to major corporations to get them engaged in on board. We do have the Smithsonian is probably the first large organization that has an operating site, and I've actually registered Shimkus for Congress or something like that for my own because what we're looking for is now participants because the
Congressman,
bigger...
Congressman, we're out of time, though. Thank you very much for being our guest.
I'm sorry. See, you got me on an issue that I like, and I could talk about it forever.
Well, we're always happy to talk with you. Keep up the good work.
Okay.
Congressman John Shimkus of the 19th Congressional District in Illinois will be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Angel worship, secret knowledge, reliance on human wisdom. Sounds like American spirituality in the 21st century, but these same heresies were also popular in the first century city of Colossae. What can we learn today from Paul's letter to the Church of Colossae? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. The phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this brand new commentary on our website, issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section. That's issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is written by Dr. Paul Dieterding and costs $39.99 plus shipping and handling. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. For more information, Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. The controversy touched off by the Episcopal Church USA electing an openly gay bishop continues. The latest evidence of the deep divide within the denomination is a change of location for the October conference of the American Anglican Council. The first location wasn't big enough. Here's Terry Phillips.
The meeting of the American Anglican Council will still be in Texas, but they're moving it from Plano to a larger convention center in nearby Dallas.
We're changing venues. We can no longer house it at our church.
David Roseberry is rector of Christ Church in Plano, the official host. In just 2 weeks of registration, the numbers exceed the church's 1,600-seat capacity. The blossoming attendance is due to one thing.
To the actions of the General Convention, which were to confirm the non-celibate homosexual man as Bishop of the Episcopal Church.
Canon David Anderson, president of the American Anglican Council, confirms the conference will draft a profound request to the highest leaders of the Anglican Communion.
We will have a petition to lay before them asking for their immediate and direct intervention into the affairs of the Episcopal Church. But it's also to prepare the people there for what will be a coming separation.
Anderson describes the AAC's view of a gay bishop elected to the Episcopal Church of the United States.
We're horrified. We're aghast that it took place. It puts the Episcopal Church not just outside of the Anglican Communion, but calls its place within the Christian faith into question.
The new location, the Anatole Convention Center, can hold 6,000 conferees. For Family News and Focus, I'm Terry Phillips.
Many attending the meeting warned Episcopal leaders of grave consequences if a gay man was elected bishop. Now, besides the impending split, some parishes and dioceses are withholding funds from the national church. For Family News and Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Have you heard about the opportunity for your congregation to become an AM 850 KFUO Church of the Week? In exchange for a financial gift to KFUO, your church will receive 35 personalized messages. That's five a day to let our listeners know what's happening at your church. Plus, once an hour, your congregation will be recognized as the Church of the Week, and your pastor will be featured on the morning show. For more information, contact Janelle Flerke at 1-888-930-4438.
What does it mean that every believer is perfect in Christ? You can find out with the new Concordia Commentary on Colossians by Dr. Paul Dieterding. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Colossians is the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this commentary at issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section.
Welcome back, folks. The rest of the hour here, the second hour, is open lines for your questions and your comments. We had to hurry Congressman Shimkus there. Usually he's the one who's hurrying away to do a vote or something. We had to hurry him as we went into the vote. I'm sorry, as we went into the break. And he was telling us how you can get involved in the .kidsus domain name. Now, this is the best information that we have as parents or even corporations. This domain, the subdomain, .kids.us, is open to commercial, governmental, nonprofit, and other parties who want to put up their websites as long as their content passes muster. Parents can demand this from corporate, governmental, or private agencies. Shimkus said that he's already been on the phone with some corporations saying this is where you ought to locate your websites to populate this subdomain, safe places for the kids to go. In other words, we're trying to create basically a safe area on the internet. I have kids at home. The older one, she knows how to use the internet. She goes down. She likes to go to her little places where they have little animals. She likes to collage. She's a collaging fool. And so she goes on websites looking for pictures of border collies or iguanas, whatever animal is striking her fancy at the moment. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, she's looking around. She's using Google to find these things. You can find all sorts of things there that you don't want your kids looking at. There needs to be a safe place. So if you've got an internet service provider, first of all, make them aware that this exists. Second of all, if you know someone who's got a website, tell them that this would be a great domain for them to locate their website, a safe place for kids on the internet. Open lines is for anything you want to talk about. 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. You just contact your internet service provider. You know who they are, usually whatever the company is, whoever gives you your internet, and say, look, there's a new subdomain out there. It's just been established. Can you give us not only give us access to it, but also can you encourage people who sign up for websites that there's a safe place for kids there? They can put their websites there. I think that's the most efficient way to get at it. It's .kids.us. What did you think of the president's address last night? Do you think he made the case he was trying to make adequately? I listened, I think it was the ABC Radio Network, and then afterwards heard Howard Dean. They had him on the phone briefly, among other people. And Howard Dean had said, you know, we need to bring those troops home. But this time, when pressed with the question, would you bring the troops home if you were president today? He said, well, you know, you can't really bring all the troops home. But we can start to bring them home. John Shimkus says, look, in for a penny, in for a pound, we need to, the best thing that we could possibly do is finish what we started. So bringing everybody home in one fell swoop or starting to rotate people back home and diminishing our numbers there may not be the goal. What struck you the most about the president's address last night, if you heard it? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the last half hour of Open Lines, I was talking about the Dalai Lama and the interfaith dialogues. This came across my desk. Oh, this was several weeks ago, I believe now. It comes from the Ecumenical News Service, Ecumenical News International. Interfaith collaboration, now central task for churches, says the World Council of Church leader. The World Council of Churches is of course, an international ecumenical organization. It has been on the forefront for about the last 30 years, on the forefront of, at first it started out to be inter-Christian ecumenism. That is, attempts at breaking down the barriers between Christian denominations and church bodies and confessions of faith. But of late, the ecumenical movement has moved beyond just the Christian circle and moved outside the Christian circle. The World Council of Churches now considers itself an interfaith, not just inter-Christian, not just among Christians, but among all religions, to pursue ecumenism, that is, the breaking down of differences and barriers, and we're talking about theological differences and barriers between religions. Here's the story from Geneva. Interfaith cooperation must become a central priority for Christian churches, one of the top leaders of the World Council of Churches said. Religions may generate mistrust and intolerance and even fuel ethnic and political conflicts unless a common ground for a harmonious coexistence is found between them. That came from Catholicos Aram I, a senior leader of the Armenian Apostolic Church and moderator of the WCC Central Committee. Interreligious dialogue, relations, and collaboration must occupy a high priority in the World Council of Churches' ecumenical witness. Apparently, according to Aram, the greatest danger in the world of religion is what he calls religious fundamentalism. The greatest enemy of religion and the most dangerous force in our times, he said. Most World Council of Churches members, Aram told the Central Committee, were unprepared to engage in interreligious dialogue. And the issue was often controversial in some churches, questioning the validity of other faiths. He acknowledged that there were limits to dialogue. Now listen very carefully. This is from, if there is an avant-garde, if there is a leading edge, any organization that is pushing for, and when I say the breaking down of barriers between religions, we're really talking about compromising our theology in order to just get along. If there was an organization, it's the World Council of Churches that is pushing for this. But listen, he says, there is limits to the dialogue, saying that he believed that Christians could not, I repeat the word, not pray together with members of other religions. Even the moderator of the World Council of Churches believes that it's a bad idea for Christians to pray together with members of other religions. You know, just when you think you got the world figured out, I guess, somebody pulls something like this. After September 11th, you would have expected, say, mainline denominations that still hold to Jesus Christ being the only way of salvation, to say, look, there are limits to what we can do even after buildings fall and planes crash. There are limits to what we can do with other religions. 2 years after September 11th, within mainline denominations, my own denomination, there are people who are saying, you know, limits schmimits. September 11th changed everything. And the moderator of the World Council of Churches, the most liberal parachurch organization ever known to exist in human history, says, you know, it's not a good idea. There are limits to this dialogue. Christians shouldn't be praying together with people of other faiths. Just when you think you got the scorecard down, you know who the players are, they all switch uniforms. I guess you could just call it irony. Here's a story that's actually been sitting in the pile a long time. But it's along these lines. I've been saving it for a day just like this. Actually, I was saving it for the week of September 11th. Members of the Catholic and Muslim faith, two of the world's largest religions, combined Sunday services in Austin, Texas. Now, this is from mid-August. This was the second time since September 11th. It's always about September 11th. That will stand out, I think, in this movement toward the merging of all religions into one. That will stand out as kind of like, that will be the day like Pentecost. That was, if Pentecost was the birth of the Christian church, September 11th was, for those who want to merge the Christian faith with all other religions, will be the death of the Christian church. Or maybe the rebirth of a new post-Christian church or something like that. The second time since September 11th, Catholics and Muslims joined together for a joint prayer service inside St. Mary's Cathedral. Now, you notice they don't do it in the mosque. Because you might irritate Muslims by doing this, bringing Christians in to pray to their false god in the mosque. It's always the Christians that compromise. Inside St. Mary's Cathedral in downtown Austin, Texas, the two religions shared the same pew, the same church, the same God. I'm just reading it, folks. Though they are very different, the two religions are very, very different. I'm sorry. Though they are very different, the two religions are very different. There is much more in common than any of us realize, said Bishop Gregory Amond of the Austin Diocese. Dressed in their respective sacred robes, one wonders why they even bother. I mean, if they're going to pray together, why not swap robes? Dressed in their respective sacred robes, Catholic and Muslim priests recited verses from the Bible and the Quran in different languages. But the message was universal. Love thy neighbor. Don't let what's here, said one of the speakers, pointing to his head, go inside our heart. Let our heart be open to each other and let our theological differences be inside. Let the differences just be inside here. That came from Imam Safdar Rassi of the Islamic Associated Mosque. I'm going to read that again. This is what the Muslim imam is saying about the theological differences between Christians and Muslims. Don't let in what's in your head go inside your heart. Let your heart be open to one another and let the theological differences be, he says, in your head. Let the differences just stay there in your head. Religious leaders say that September 11th terrorist attack spurred a dialogue between the two communities and that they've transformed that into prayer. I did feel overwhelmed and moved and felt very good about what the pastor and the imam said one Muslim member. So the pastor, I assume, was not proclaiming Jesus Christ to be the only way of salvation. I would find it difficult for a Muslim observing that to feel very good about such a statement. These kinds of opportunities to come together foster the dream of Jesus becoming a reality said the bishop. That dream of God that will be one human family united under God, God must be smiling with great joy upon our efforts, said the bishop. News to me. Jesus had this dream that will be one human family united under God. And it would be achieved, apparently, according to this bishop, by Muslims and Catholics joining together in the Catholic cathedral to pray together and to worship together and to keep their differences in their heads and not in their hearts. The imams have also invited Amand, who is the Catholic bishop, to speak at their mosque to continue the religious and cultural exchange. Now, I seem to remember Jesus saying something, I think it's around John chapter 17, saying, praying that they may all be one. But I think he was talking about his disciples. Let them be one as you and I, O Father, are one. He was talking about the perfect unity of faith and not about a unity that is achieved by keeping your differences locked away in your head. At least I think that's what he was talking about. The phone numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Your reaction to President Bush's speech last night, it was rare. We don't often get to hear these. What did you think of it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Well, the VeggieTale creators, according to Christianity Today, are filing for bankruptcy. Bob the Tomato and his friends have been sold to a company that already owns the rights to Lassie, the Lone Ranger, and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Big Idea Productions, makers of the best-selling VeggieTales video series, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy Tuesday last week. As part of a deal to sell the financially troubled company, Big Idea has agreed to sell its assets, including the copyrights to Bob the Tomato and Larry the Cucumber and other VeggieTales characters, to Classic Media LLC, which owns and manages media properties such as Rocky and Bullwinkle, Lassie the Lone Ranger, and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I thought Santa owned Rudolph. I mean, maybe he sold them to Classic Media LLC, too. Despite Big Idea's continued popularity, 8 of the top 10 selling videos in the Christian retail market are produced by Big Idea, including the recently released The Ballad of Little Joe. The company has had cash flow problems in recent years. Last November, following the release of the motion picture Jonah, a VeggieTale movie, which was delightfully entertaining, almost entirely devoid of anything distinctly Christian, a nice little moral tale, but entertaining nonetheless. It grossed $24 million at the box office. Big Idea, after the release of the movie, had to lay off 30 employees. Additional layoffs have cut the company staff from a high of 200 part-time and full-time employees to the current staff of 44. To call last year difficult is an understatement, said Big Idea founder and CEO Phil Vischer in a statement. In the midst of VeggieTales' success, we made several key strategic errors that led us to this point. Due to their great enthusiasm for both our business and our ministry, I believe Classic Media is a wonderful partner to help Big Idea back to financial health. Chris Furr, a spokesman for Big Idea, said that the company intends to continue making VeggieTale videos with an Easter special due for release next February, followed by videos in May and September. Plans for a second VeggieTale film announced last fall, however, are now on hold. The projects that are ready to go are going to be produced, but they have to fit the appropriate business model under Chapter 11. The Jonah film, I mean, you're wondering, its gross is $24 million at the box office. So what's the problem? The Jonah film, which cost an estimated $10 million to $20 million to produce, was self-financed by Big Idea. The company would take on financing partners for our future film projects, said Chief Operating Officer Terry Pefanis in a statement. Now, they're selling videotapes as well. It's not just box office gross. $20 million in video sales Big Idea was once the largest animation studio in the Midwest. The company will now focus on story concepts and pre-production, and the animation production will be outsourced. So you don't know where, including the fact that Bob and Larry will be wholly owned subsidiaries of a big media conglomerate. They will also be animated probably someplace in Korea. Big Idea began to look for a buyer last summer after it lost a lawsuit by Lyric Studios, its distributor, in 2001. Lyric, which also produces Barney, sued after Big Idea switched to Warner Home Entertainment to distribute its videos to mainstream markets. Ah, and this is where the problem came in. A Texas jury awarded Lyric $11 million in damages, deciding that Big Idea violated a verbal contract. So that's how you end up. $11 million in damages in court for switching distributors gets you in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, while you're still outselling everyone in the video market. Did you know that the president has proclaimed several days here this week to be days of prayer and remembrance? Taking note, and this is according to Baptist Press, taking note of the upcoming second anniversary of terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, President Bush has issued a proclamation designating September 5th through the 7th. Where are we? Oh, it's already over. It was the weekend, and we didn't even know it. National Days of Prayer and Remembrance. The president's proclamation focused on the victims of the attacks, their families, and the nation. It states in full, as we approach the second anniversary of September 11th, 2001, we remember all that we lost as Americans and recognize all that we have witnessed about the character of America. During these national days of prayer and remembrance, we honor those who were killed and their families, and we ask God for strength and wisdom as we carry out the noble mission that our nation began that morning. Now, that's the way to mark September 11th. Call people to prayer. Now, you notice he doesn't say, you got to pray together. He just says, days of prayer and remembrance. And probably in typical U.S. president fashion, visit the place of worship of your choice. Now, I'm wondering if he would have called us all to pray together, whether some might have considered that carte blanche to go and do it. Maybe so. What are you doing for September 11th? As far as I know, my church isn't having anything special for September 11th. Is yours? Or is 2 years just too long? I mean, for heaven's sakes, it's been 2 years. If you get a chance, pick out the paper from Saturday and read Leonard Pitts. This is this last Saturday, 2 days ago. Read his article. He writes for the Miami Herald, by the way, but you can get it in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Saturday's edition. The headline is Absolute Certainty God is Neither a Hitman Nor a Pimp. Now, I'll be quite honest with you. Most of the time, when I read Leonard Pitts in the Post-Dispatch, especially when it's on the issue that he's addressing here, I disagree with him. But I'm seeing here someone on the edge, not on the wrong edge, someone who's actually sitting on the fence. Now, he's talking about Paul Hill and his execution. He's talking about Paul Hill's total lack of doubt as to whether or not he might have been doing the right thing, his total lack of remorse. He's talking about the fact that Paul Hill, if asked if Jesus Christ would have pulled the trigger of the 12-gauge shotgun he used to kill an abortion doctor and his bodyguard, whether or not Jesus would have pulled the trigger, that Paul Hill said, absolutely. He talks a bit about people hearing from God and how most people who hear from God at least have the good sense to question whether or not, you know, to struggle with this, am I actually hearing from God? Paul Hill apparently didn't. This is what he says near the end. and I ask you to read it for yourself. This is one of those cases where I think Leonard Pitts, he's sitting on the fence, and he's telling us something, especially pro-lifers, that we need to hear. For the record, he says, I find it chilling to think that government could force a woman to bear a child. Now, there he is stating a pretty clear kind of the mantra of the pro-choice side of things. And he is pro-choice, as far as I know. And yes, no government forces women to bear that. For the government to say that abortion is wrong would not be to force women to bear their children. Women make that choice back. I think it has, at least if I was paying attention to biology class, that starts back at that moment of conception. No one forces that. But read on, please, bear up and read on. He says, I am galled by people who seem to think that the only purpose of sex is procreation. I'm honest enough to admit, though, now listen, that the pro-life folks get to me sometimes. There is a certain moral weight to their observation that abortion stills a beating heart. But that weight is compromised, he says, every time the movement produces a zealot like Paul Hill. Now go and read the column. Here is a guy who's saying to pro-lifers, you know what? You've got a point. Abortion does kill. But every time the movement produces, or in some cases, either says hooray to, or, well, hooray, I think, or, well, I don't agree with what he did, but boy, I sure am glad he did it. Every time the movement produces a Paul Hill scenario, guys like Leonard Pitts, who may be on the edge there, who are pro-choice, but say, look, you got a moral point. Abortion takes a life. They say all that moral weight disappears and evaporates. It's something we need to hear. Folks, before we go into the third hour, let me tell you about our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. It's the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Colossians, a good commentary that follows the text of this book and gives you this kind of word-for-word analysis that we need for in-depth Bible study. You can order the book online tonight at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section, and you'll find information on the commentary. Or call Concordia Publishing House tomorrow during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. Ask to receive the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, the Concordia Commentary on Colossians, 1-800-325-3040. The third hour of Issues Etc. is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.